Most of us, I guess, if we're honest, struggle with change. You know, we have the way we do things, and when it doesn't work out, we find that hard. You know, be it the little things of life. You know, your favourite coffee shop shuts down, and oh my goodness me, where do I buy coffee now? You know, to the kind of the major things of life. You know, you move home, you move job, and there's the uncertainty that comes with that. And often it's the fear of change that hinders, that can be a barrier to people coming to faith, to following Jesus. It's not that they don't necessarily believe who Jesus is and why he has come. It's not that they necessarily disagree with any of that. But they don't like what it will mean. They don't like that they might have to give up some things in their life if they begin to follow him. They don't like the changes that Jesus will bring. And Luke 5 reveals, as it were, why those changes are necessary as Jesus challenges the Pharisees, who also don't like change. So let's have a look then. Firstly then, Jesus is the long-awaited bridegroom. It's time for change. Jesus is the long-awaited bridegroom. It's time for change. So the religious leaders, the Pharisees, they've come to watch Jesus and listen to him. Seen that in chapter 5, verse 17. And we've seen that they've been offended by Jesus forgiving sins in verse 21. They don't like the fact that he hangs out with sinners in verse 30. And now things are beginning to be cranked up, as it were, as Jesus refuses to comply with their pious practices, verse 33. See, John's disciples, we read, often fast and pray. So do the disciples of the Pharisees. But yours go on eating and drinking. Now, the law of Moses, as recorded for us in the Old Testament, demanded that God's people should fast only once a year on the Day of Atonement. It's the one day of the year where sacrifices were offered for the sins of the whole nation of Israel. And on that day, the nation was to fast. They were to abstain from food. They were to humble themselves. It was a mark of their grief and mourning of their sin. Now, there were other occasions and sacrifices where a Jew might fast. But only on the Day of Atonement was it commanded. The Pharisees, however, were particularly devout. They fasted twice a week. Their fasting was designed both to indicate a humble mourning at sin. It was to intensify spiritual experience. We learn from the other Gospels it was a mark of their piety as well. And we learn as well that even John the Baptist's disciples prayed and fasted frequently, possibly following the custom of the day set by the Pharisees. But Jesus' disciples did not fast. And verses 34 to 35 explain why. Have a look. Jesus says to them, look, can you make the friends of the bridegroom fast while he is with them? But the time will come when the bridegroom will be taken from them. In those days, they will fast. Now, as Jesus says this, he's not kind of given an illustration. This is not a kind of a little story about weddings that illustrates why his disciples are not fasting in the way that I might give an illustration in a sermon to kind of help clarify or to bring understanding, much as what I'm doing right now. When Jesus speaks of being the bridegroom, he's using a title for himself. See, God, together with his anointed Messiah, are depicted throughout the Old Testament as the ideal bridegroom for God's people. So think back to Genesis 2. Adam and Eve, created in the image of God, they're brought together as husband and wife, and their relationship is designed to mirror the true relationship with God, for which all of humanity is created for. And then throughout the Old Testament, God is presented as the husband of his people. So Isaiah 54, verse 5, or Hosea 2, verse 7. And God's king, his anointed, the Messiah, is also depicted both in the Song of Songs and Psalm 45 as the ideal bridegroom for his people as well. And God, as the bridegroom to his people, promises his people that he has prepared a perfect wedding feast for them, where all the spoils of this fallen world will be restored. And so we read in Isaiah 25, verses 6 to 9. You might want to just turn to it. I'll read it to you. So we read Isaiah 25. On this mountain, the Lord Almighty will prepare a feast of rich food for all peoples, a banquet of aged wine, the best of meats and the finest of wines. On this mountain, he will destroy the shroud that enfolds all people, the sheet that covers all nations. He will swallow up death forever. The sovereign Lord will wipe away the tears from all faces. He will remove his people's disgrace from all the earth. The Lord has spoken. In that day, they will say, surely this is our God. We trusted in him and he saved us. This is the Lord, we trusted in him. Let us rejoice and be glad in his salvation. And so when Jesus answers the question in verse 34, this is far more than a call for the Pharisees to be happy. You know, guys, stop being grumpy and join the party. No, Jesus is claiming to be the bridegroom. And that is a claim, at the very least, to his royalty, to being God's king, and possibly even to his divinity. And as such, it is highly inappropriate for his disciples to fast when the bridegroom for God's people has arrived. Just as fasting at any wedding is inappropriate. I mean, imagine going to a wedding and you get to the wedding reception and everyone just sits there with sad faces and mourns. Now, maybe there are some weddings when that should be, but we won't go there. But imagine just how bad that would be. How much more so when the bridegroom turns up? And the Pharisees of all people should have grasped this. I mean, in light of all that they have witnessed and heard, I mean, Jesus casting out demons, Jesus healing the sick, Jesus forgiving sins, all things the Old Testament foretold that the Messiah, God's bridegroom, would do. But they don't understand the times they're in. They don't see who he is. They don't grasp. No, these are days of celebration. The bridegroom's here. He's come to do what God has promised he would do. Now, while insisting that his arrival did mean that it was a time for celebration, Jesus doesn't allow his disciples to get carried away and think that all that the Messiah had promised would happen now. So we read verse 35. But the time will come when the bridegroom will be taken away from them, in those days they will fast. And that little phrase, taken away, suggests forcible removal. Jesus is already conscious of the cross, conscious of the hostility towards him, even at this very early stage in his ministry. Yeah, the Messiah was here. Yes, it was time to celebrate. He was beginning to his work and fulfilling his promises. But to do that, he'd have to go. He'd have to die. And then you fast as you wait for him to come again and to fully fulfill all that he had promised to do. But it's worth noting here, Jesus doesn't command us to fast. It's not we are to, it's a kind of we might fast. And so there are times when it's right and appropriate for us to fast, to focus our minds in prayer, possibly to seek the Lord's guidance. But much more so, as we wait for him to come again, as we yearn for his kingdom to come, as we yearn for his will to be done on earth as it is in heaven. And so it's appropriate at times to mourn, to focus our mind in prayer as we yearn and pray and long for those who are lost in our family and our friends to come and hear the good news of the bridegroom and all that he has promised. And so there are times when it's appropriate to fast. And Jesus, having established his identity, then tells the Pharisees three little parables. And he does so to confirm his claim to be God's bridegroom, God's king. And the first parable, we read verse 36, he says, "But no one tears a piece of a new garment to patch an old one. Otherwise, they will have torn the new garment, and the patch from the new will not match the old." And Jesus here is speaking of the radical new nature of his work. In other words, Jesus cannot be simply tacked onto the old. You can't simply add him to the old ways of Judaism, because then both the new and the old garment are ruined and ineffective. No, it needs a whole new garment. And the second parable builds on that, verse 37. "No one pours new wine into old wineskins. Otherwise, the new wine will burst the skins. The wine will run out and the wineskins will be ruined. No, new wine must be poured into new wineskins." If you know anything about wine back then, wineskins were made from animal skins, and if you poured new wine into older wineskins, well, as the new wine fermented, it would expand, and these old skins, having lost their kind of elasticity and being old and brittle, would burst. And so you put new wine into new wineskins that have the ability to stretch. You can't mix the old and the new. Radical change is needed. You can't simply pour the gospel into the old religious structures of Israel's religion. The new ways in which God is dealing with humanity through Jesus cannot be mixed with the old ways. No, you need a whole new wineskin. See, in effect, what Jesus is doing is he's laying out his manifesto. He has come as God's anointed king, the bridegroom of God's people. He's come with God's authority to forgive sins, verse 24. This will have implications on old Judaism. It will have implications for the temple. It will have implications for the priesthood. It will have implication for the leaders. Now that the anointed one has arrived, these old ways are redundant. You don't need to sacrifice at a temple anymore. You don't need to go to a temple anymore. You don't need a priest anymore. Or you won't. See, Jesus and his word cannot simply be tacked onto the old or poured into existing structures. No, it's time for change. And Jesus is challenging these Pharisees who are desperate to hold on to their old ways and their laws and their positions and their authority and, as it were, their lives. Their way of making themselves right with God by being devout and pious and doing all that they thought was right. And he challenges them in light of who he is and what he's come to do. But he knows they'll resist. See verse 39, the third parable. It's probably more of a saying than a parable, but it reveals the inevitable hostility to such change. Jesus says, "And no one after drinking old wine wants the new, for they say the old is better." And if you put it into a modern proverb, it'd be something like, "You can't teach an old dog new tricks." Has that sense about it. Jesus is saying that these Pharisees will desperately hold on to the old. They'll say it's better, even though the new is come. They'll resist the change. And friends, Jesus challenges us in the same way. You can't follow Jesus by simply tacking him on, pouring him into old ways and old systems and old lifestyles and the old ways you thought that made you right with God. I mean, yeah, we're not tacking him onto Judaism, but we tack him onto our old life, our old ways. No, Jesus brings change. He brings whole life transformation. And yet so often we want to cling onto our old lives and our old ways to keep doing things my way. To do things that we think make us right with God. So we'll say things like, well, I believe in Jesus and I keep coming to church every now and then, and but I don't need to go the whole way, do I? End that inappropriate relationship. stop getting drunk every weekend, stop my gambling habit, stop my porn gazing, start doing all that he says. Surely, no, I believe enough. I mean, I might do some naughty things, but I'm a good person. And Jesus says, no, it's new wineskins. You can't just simply bolt me on, as it were, to your original life plan. Following me involves change. It involves whole life transformation. It means stop doing things your way, start doing things his way, with him as the king and in charge. And it will mean ongoing change. We don't just stop some things when we first believe. No, we keep stopping that which is not of him, to become more and more like him. It's new wineskins. It's new clothing. It's not a tack on. Can't hold on to the old and pour in the new. Where is it that Jesus wants you to change? Where does he want you to get rid of the old and put on the new? What is it that you're desperately clinging on to? What habit? What relationship? What unhelpful sin? And then to drive the kind of the teaching home, Jesus shows through a worked example how these changes will take effect as he applies it to the law and the Sabbath. See, Jesus, the long-awaited bridegroom, it's time for change, but we also see in chapter 6, verses 1 to 5, Jesus is Lord of the Sabbath. It's all about him. See, have a look. We read, one Sabbath, Jesus was going through the grain fields and his disciples began to pick some heads of grain and rub them in their hands and eat the kernels. And some of the Pharisees asked, why are you doing what is unlawful on the Sabbath? Now we need to understand the purpose of the Sabbath. The purpose of the Sabbath was for God's people to be marked out as those who were looking forward to the new creation. Sabbath simply means rest. Oh, there we go. And in Genesis 2:2, we read, God rested from his work and all that he'd done. It doesn't say God finished working. It's not that God stopped working. John chapter 5, we discover he's always working. Nor could God have been tired. No, rather God's rest or Sabbath was for the purpose for which he created the universe. Genesis 2, we see it involved God and humanity enjoying one another, living together in Eden, in his perfect world. But following Adam and Eve's rebellion, they're expelled from God's perfect rest. They're consigned to live in a world under God's judgment. And under Moses, the Sabbath day is established in order that God's people might rest from physical labor, so that on the one day of a week, they might enjoy their relationship with God, for which God had rescued them from the Egyptians for, and so that they could look forward to the rest of his new creation. Now, our dear friends, the Pharisees, these guys, I think, would do extreme sports in our day and age. But instead of doing extreme sport, they did extreme piety. They had a list, an additional 613 commandments to ensure that the Sabbath day was kept. These guys knew how to party. And there were 39 categories of forbidden work alone. Among these was the work of reaping, threshing, winnowing, and preparing food, which is what the Pharisees are accusing the disciples and in turn Jesus of doing. And so the Pharisees' accusation here of Jesus in 6 verse 2 is on the basis of their interpretation of the law and on the basis of their added laws. That must be, because otherwise the accusation, had it been valid, would have convicted the disciples of sin and by implication Jesus as well. And it can't be that Jesus broke the commandment of the Sabbath. In fact, the law allowed for exactly what the disciples were doing. And so at this point, Jesus could have chosen to have pointed out to the Pharisees that their definition of what constituted work was quite arbitrary and had no authority within Scripture. But instead, Jesus uses it to kind of raise the stakes, to reveal more of who he was and what he had come to do, and to help them to grasp the true nature, the true purpose of the Sabbath that they had missed. And Jesus does it by using a brilliantly chosen reference from the Old Testament, which not only underlines his claim to the Davidic throne, that he's God's anointed king, but the situation Jesus and his disciples find themselves in is remarkably similar to that of David. See, David is God's anointed, he's God's king, he's in need. He's on the run. He's on the run from Saul, the false pretender to the throne, someone who is seeking to challenge his authority. At this point, read Pharisees. David enters the tabernacle, the house of God, and he takes the consecrated bread. And David eats what is lawful only for the priest to eat, and he also gives some to his companions. Now, the law governing the consecrated bread was not a moral law, but a religious regulation. The strict consecration of the bread to God and to his priests was designed to teach the Israelites the holiness of the Lord and the sacredness of his service. And as such, normally, the symbols of that service were forbidden to non-priests. But the occasion recorded in 1 Samuel 21 was no normal occasion, and David was no ordinary citizen. He's God's anointed king. He's fleeing for his life. He's desperately hungry. And it was of paramount importance to the Lord that the Lord's anointed should be fed. And it was therefore perfectly proper that a symbol whose strict consecration was designed to teach Israel to revere the service of the Lord should be used to serve the needs of the Lord's anointed. The law, the regulations with its demand, was therefore to serve the king, because it's all about him. See, the Pharisees should have realized that a similar situation was confronting them. Jesus, the true bridegroom, God's anointed, was present. As such, in light of the fact that Scripture itself allowed exceptions to religious regulations under certain circumstances, they should have realized this. That's why Jesus says, verse 3, "Have you not read?" In other words, you should have picked this up, guys, that what Jesus and his disciples were doing was in no way unlawful, actually, by the law itself, but even by their own laws. Based on the Scriptures and David's example, the needs of the king supersede the religious regulations, even theirs. It's all about him. And if that's kind of not enough, Jesus then kind of drives it home. Jesus says, look, the Son of Man, kingship title, verse 5, is Lord of the Sabbath. Far from doing anything wrong, it's all about him. Everything that the Sabbath anticipated is to be found in him. The Sabbath was made for Jesus. He is the rest. He's the rest to which the Sabbath pointed. And now that he has arrived, all the Sabbath legislation, including all of their 613 laws, is to be reinterpreted in light of him. Just as the rules regarding the consecrated bread was reinterpreted in light of King David, so the rules concerning the Sabbath are reinterpreted in light of the Lord of the Sabbath. See, it's no longer about keeping a day. It's all about him. and how you relate to him. Because he's the true rest. And new wine requires new wineskins. And you can't take the Lord of the Sabbath and seek to fit him into your old ways. And the dear Pharisees, they want to make the Sabbath and the rest and all it pointed to stood about a day and their rules and what you did on that day and how you did it on that day. And Jesus says, no, it's not about a day. It's all about me. The Sabbath serves me. I'm the Lord of the Sabbath. I'm the rest. I am the one who will bring about the new creation. I am the one, therefore, to enjoy. I am the one, as it were, that will now mark you. No longer will you be marked out as God's people by upholding a Sabbath day. You'll be marked, set aside by your relationship to me. It's all about me. And Jesus is helping these Pharisees to see. It's all change. It's not about laws. It's not what you do on a particular day. It's all about him. And yet, how often do I want to make it all about me and my rules and not about Jesus and who he is? I want to make it all about what I do. I want to make it about all that I've done. I read the whole Bible in a year. I pray every day. I spoke of Jesus to my neighbor and my neighbor's friend. I come every Sunday. Morning and afternoon and evening. I hear every community group. I make every prayer meeting. I've given more than 10%. I've served in various groups on various days. I've even got time off work this week to be on holiday Bible club. And I look at these things and I think, hey, they are what mark me. They are what make me holy. They are what will keep me in God's good book so he'll just keep on blessing me. And when I do those things, oh, I know I'll be in heaven. Oh, I know it's all about Jesus. But when I do those things, then I'm certain I'm in heaven. And Jesus says, no. It's all about me. It's me who marks you. It's me who keeps you. It's me who brings you into the rest. It's me who keeps you in the rest. And yeah, look, the principles behind the Sabbath, they're still good. So having a day off is good. And setting aside a day to meet with other believers and to remind ourselves and fix our eyes on Jesus and look forward together to the rest is good. But it's good only if it points you to Jesus, keeps you connected to him. Just as reading our Bibles and praying and serving and giving and serving a holiday Bible club, they're all good things to do, great things to do, excellent things to do, but not in and of themselves. But because they point me to Jesus, to share in his joy, to keep me dependent on him, to express my love and worship of him. You see, it's not about what I do. It's not about a particular day. It's all about him. It's all about what he will do. It's all about what he has done and how I relate to him. So how are you relating to him? How is your relationship with him? You just feel yourself going through the religious will, on the religious treadmill, as it were? Or do you have a relationship where you love him and he loves you and you know that and you're just resting and dependent on him? And you serve and you read and you seek and you give and you share and you share the good news of Christ because you love him, not because you want something from him. Jesus, the Lord of the Sabbath, is all about him. But then thirdly, Jesus is the King. It's only he who restores, verses 6 to 11. It's only he who restores. See, now the Pharisees' hostility is beginning to rise to a murderous pitch. He's challenging their laws. He's challenging their ways. He's challenging their authority. He's challenging their special days. And they're now actively seeking to catch Jesus out. They're looking for a reason to accuse him. Have a look at verse 7. They're watching him closely. And the words used here have kind of a sinister undertone to it. They're spying. They're watching out the corner of their eyes. It's great, isn't it? Here they all are. In the synagogue. on the Sabbath again. Jesus is teaching. There's a man with a shriveled hand. And the Pharisees are desperate. They want Jesus to heal him so that they can accuse him. But, verse 8, don't you just love this bit? Jesus knows what they're thinking. And his deliberate decision of what he does and says is designed to both simultaneously to confront and to expose their hypocrisy. The question in verse 9, together with the intense examination in verse 10 and the subsequent miracle, provide the most compelling evidence so far that the old garments and the old wineskins of the religious establishment need replacing. Because these old ways with these old leaders are going to do harm, not good. And so Jesus commands the man with a shriveled hand to get up and stand in front of everyone. And Jesus asks them, what is lawful on the Sabbath? To do good or to do evil? To save life or destroy life? Now again, our friends the Pharisees, extreme pietists, forbid any medical intervention on the Sabbath, unless the person was in mortal danger of losing their life, or a baby was to be born, or a circumcision needed to be performed. Why, that couldn't wait. But a man having his shriveled hand healed was not something to be done on the Sabbath. It could wait. But the Sabbath was the day in which the people of God were meant to be looking forward to the new creation, where the Lord restored all that is broken in this fallen world. So what better day to heal and restore a man with a shriveled hand? And so Jesus' question gets to the heart of it. Do good or do evil? Save life or destroy it? And with that, verse 10, he looks around. He eyeballs everyone. Imagine how you would feel. Jesus is eyeballing you. And then he speaks. He doesn't touch. He doesn't work. He just speaks. Stretch out your hand. And the hand was completely restored. And note the word restored. Restoration is what the king would do in the new creation. It's the very thing the Sabbath day is looking forward to. Here is the king restoring his kingdom. The king is doing what he would do. It's evident that Jesus is the bridegroom. He's the Son of Man. He is the king who has come to do good and who has come to save. That's what he's promising. That's what he's come to do. Good. And to save. And he'll ultimately do that on the cross. On the cross, he will do good. And he will save as he bears the punishment for our sin and restores us to relationship with God the Father and restores us for all eternity if we place our trust in him. He's come to do good and to save. And the contrast is then evident. The Pharisees are so intent upon protecting their own man-made rules that they're neither willing to do good or to save life. Such that we read verse 11, they're furious. And on the Sabbath of all days, they begin to discuss what they might do to Jesus. Far from doing good, they do evil. Far from saving life, they're plotting to harm and kill God's anointed. See, such is the hypocrisy of man that as we reject our Maker, we choose harm over good, destruction over salvation. They ignore what the King has come to do. And all they seek to do is hold on to their man-made rules. And friends, we need to see. To oppose Jesus is to oppose what is good. to choose man-made religious structures in opposition to Christ, however beneficial they may appear. Roman Catholicism, Islam, Judaism, and let's throw in secularism. No, it's ironic, man-made religious, but we'll go with it. To choose man-made religious structures in opposition to Christ is to stand against what is good and what saves lives. It's to choose harm over good, destruction over salvation, because only the King can restore. It's new wineskins. It's new clothes that are needed. And the reality is, whenever one challenges man-made religion, from the denominations to secularism, when you're challenging man's own thinking and man's own rules and man's own regulations and man's own self-righteousness and man's interpretation of this world, one will be met with a furious reaction, because you're daring to challenge their self-governing authority, their control, their power, all that is in their hand. You touch that, you can guarantee a reaction. And they'll seek ways to oppose. You oppose a secular government, they'll begin to legislate against you speaking out in the streets, or in your workplace, or in your schools. And let's be very clear what's happening there. They are doing harm rather than good. They're destroying lives rather than saving lives. They are robbing people of the truth that has power to set them free, to do them good, to save. And when religious denominations water the truth of the gospel down, they are ultimately harming humanity. They are doing that which is not good. And they're destroying lives, not saving lives. When religious authorities, when a secular government seeks to hinder the gospel and oppose the truth, they are ultimately harming humanity. And we need to grasp that. We need to grasp that to understand why we're rejected and why we need to stand firm and oppose. That actually when those regulations come down and we're told we're not allowed to speak of Jesus in the streets, we're not allowed to speak of him in our workplace, we have to recognize that that is not for good. That harms. It destroys life, not saves life. And therefore it is right to stand up and oppose. Yes, we must do it in ways that are gracious and kind and must make sure that we fulfill our work and do our duty right. Absolutely. But let's not be fooled into thinking that this is a good thing. No, it harms life and destroys life. And friends, we need to stand firm, because only Jesus is the King who can restore. No one else, nothing else, no other authority, no other regulation, only Jesus. So stand firm. Only Jesus comes to do good. Only Jesus can save.